Joining us now on the program, Dr. Joanne Kong. Thanks for being with us, Joanne.
Thank you. So glad to be with you all today.
Joanne, can we start out by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got into veganism?
Yes, I was a long-time vegetarian. In fact, I first became vegetarian while I was living in Texas.
Wow.
And that was in the early 80s, which was a long time ago before.
And you were the only one.
Right, yeah. And of course, now I am vegan, and I've been going around the country and around the world advocating for animals and the environment and the power of plant-based nutrition for about the past 5 years. And I have found that veganism is so unique because it touches on so many different aspects of our lives. And I think more and more people are awakening to just how powerful veganism is. So I feel excited to be part of a growing vegan community.
Yeah. Well, I think for most people, it's either for the health, for the environment,
right,
or for the animals. Did you have one particular cause that spoke to you first?
Definitely for the animals. And for me, the good health was just kind of like a side benefit. And it's interesting how I've met so many people who have told me that they first went plant-based for the health reasons, which is certainly a good choice. But then the more and more they lived as vegans, they realized the deeper meaning behind it, how it's to lessen suffering, and it's how to have this greater sense of connection with not only our fellow living beings, but our natural environment.
Yeah, it's hopeful that most people who go for health will stay with it like that instead of saying, well, I'm healthy now and I miss hamburgers.
Oh, right, right. Then they have an excuse, right, to say, oh, this one time at the family picnic,
yeah,
I'll have a hamburger.
You know, there's one aspect that rarely gets discussed that you gave a talk on at the North American Vegetarian Society Summer Fest, which was the social aspect of veganism and how meat eating affects certain members of our society. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I gave a talk on the social damage of factory farms while I was at this last summer's NAB Summer Fest. And a lot of people were glad to see that this was addressed because it's not only the animals and the environment, it's the untold suffering and psychological damage that these factory farm workers experience. A large majority are undocumented workers, migrants, people seeking asylum. And for a lot of these people, this is really the only job that they can take on. And, you know, you just read about it, and it's just horrifying. It's among all jobs that one could have, it's the most prone to injury, repetitive motion injury, the fact that they work long hours with little or no breaks. They're constantly subjected to, you know, the constant noise and just being in violence. I mean, some of the workers describe how horrible it is that you're part of this big death machine, and really you're just a small part of that entire process. And also the workers that, you know, I hadn't thought about this before, but at the end of each day in a slaughterhouse, the machinery needs to be totally cleaned. And so there are special workers that take care of cleaning every bit of machinery, and people suffer amputations. Some people have been ground up alive. They virtually have disappeared. So it's just this massive physical injury. But beyond that, you can imagine how it has such an impact upon your psyche and your emotion. It's very similar to post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's very common for a lot of these workers to bring that attitude, that psychological suffering and damage, to their family lives. So around the slaughterhouses, those rural poor communities see higher rates of domestic violence, mm-hmm, and abuse. So, you know, I think it's so critical to look at the entirety of animal agriculture and how all of us, all beings, suffer because of it.
I think it's been brought into public attention a little bit because of the recent raids in Mississippi of the factory farms and slaughterhouses.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and as I said, for some of these migrant workers, this is really their only employment option. And these are jobs that a lot of U.S. citizens, they do not want to take, you know.
Something that really bugs me is this happened years ago, but I don't know whether it's still happening. But Tyson Foods ran a recruiting office in Mexico, and they gave the workers phony papers and bused them into the United States to work in slaughterhouses. And Tyson was given a slap on the wrist for that illegal activity.
Of course. Yeah, and they also even help the applicants fill out their application forms because, of course, many of them don't speak English. They don't know how to fill out the form. So, as you mentioned, they do everything possible not only to help them fill out the applications, but they're totally taking advantage of them.
Yeah, and like you said, they're just exposed to hour after hour, day after day of this horrific violence of, you know, basically ripping an animal to shreds to take every single part of the animal, I think, is basically used. And somebody's job is all day long just shooting or slaughter or slitting the throat of something. Yeah, you could imagine the emotional toll that goes on with that's your job and listening to those sounds and smells. It sounds horrific.
Yeah, and I think one way that they kind of dehumanize the workers, too, is that there's like over 130 or so different specific jobs along the factory farm assembly line or slaughterhouse line. One worker may be required to cut this part of the animal. Another worker gathers these feces or body parts. It's very, very process-oriented. It's not unlike other assembly lines. You can imagine like building cars or whatever. It's become totally systematized. So workers are totally focused on just that one aspect of the job, and they don't necessarily see the animal being killed unless you're the one that slashes the animal's throat. But it's very highly mechanized, and humans are simply used as a part of that whole system.
Right. Well, you know, when you were talking, it reminded me of many years ago here in Texas, we used to have the horse slaughter plants, and we had that exact same situation with the mayor of Kaufman, Texas, came out and fought the plant because they did see that, you know, the business tries to promote there's all this going to be economic growth and improvement for the community. And what turned out to be is, you know, there was blood filling up in people's bathtubs and sewers were being backed up from the horses. And then they also did see an increase in crime and an increase in domestic violence. So you do see this, and we saw this back here in Texas. Unfortunately, they closed that plant. It's not legal now to have slaughter in Texas, but I think maybe to turn this onto a positive note is, and building on Greg's story about Tyson, is now Tyson actually getting into the plant-based food business. So maybe there's some hope here.
Yeah. I mean, it all comes down to economics, right? Because people are starting to see the writing on the wall that plant-based eating is not just a trend. It's already a large part of the market. And I did want to mention to your readers, there's one really excellent book. Have you heard of it? It's called Every 12 Seconds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I haven't read it.
Yeah,
but
it's by Timothy Pacharat. It's Pacharat. And he actually went undercover at a slaughterhouse in Omaha, Nebraska. And his book talks in great detail about all the aspects of what one goes through as a worker in a slaughterhouse.
Mm. Yeah. Well, maybe switching gears just a bit, I did get a chance to catch your TED Talk, which was great.
Thank you.
And one of the things that you said is you talked about how meat is the new tobacco, and that struck out to me as, you know, very media worthy, I guess, and worth attention and thinking about. So what do you mean as meat is the new tobacco?
Yeah, so there's this wonderful graphic that PCRM has put out that says meat is the new tobacco, and it actually has a graphic of what looks like a pack of cigarettes, but there's hot dogs sticking out of the box, and it lists all of the diseases from smoking, and alongside that lists all the diseases from consuming animals and animal products. And Dr. Michael Greger, in his talks, speaks about how the public slowly came around to the fact that it's harmful to smoke, and he points out that it's going to be a longer haul, but he hopes that eventually society will feel the same way about consuming animals, that there's just overwhelming scientific evidence tied to all kinds of diseases and conditions. So,
I like to think that tobacco is just a little bit more addictive than meat. Sometimes it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're right. You know, society does take its time. I was just telling our co-host here that my father had a massive heart attack last week. And he's fine now. But what was most what I found very troubling was the first meal they served him after he came out of his surgery for having, you know, extensive coronary disease. Was eggs for breakfast and and pork for lunch. And I'm like, is this the heart healthy diet? And they're like, yeah, it's low. They're like, yeah, it's low in salt. So I was like, this is really disappointing. If you're in the cardiac unit and they're still serving food like that to the patients.
Well, that's why Michael Greger says that the medical profession is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States.
Yeah, and I do know that PCRM was instrumental in getting a resolution passed by the American Medical Association to urge hospitals to stop serving processed meats and serve plant-based meals. So hopefully this will start to happen. I mean, it's just amazing that the medical community, they're making profits, right, off of disease, off of people getting sick. The last thing they want to do from a profit-based viewpoint is to help people stay healthy in a preventive kind of way, because there's no money in that, right?
Right. Well, and I think, and you know, in your talk, you elaborated on that there's major health organizations now that are paying attention to the plant-based diet. It was American Cancer Society, Harvard School of Public Health, the National Institutes of Health. So I think that it's a great sign for us that they're taking this seriously. And I think and going back to the smoking point is, I think, you know, the nice thing is for people who feel like there's no hope for their health or their health issues. I mean, some people see within 2 to 3 weeks, see a positive response in their health just by changing a few things that they have in their diet.
And if meat is the new tobacco, then I'm hoping that restaurants will soon have a back room for meat eaters.
Oh, that's wonderful.
There is one very vegan-friendly restaurant here in El Paso we have several. We have about 4 or 5 vegan restaurants. But one that is mostly vegan, their menu is all vegan. And then there's a little box in the corner that says If you're a carnivore, we also can add meat or eggs to your meal.
Okay.
And,
At
least they've been relegated down to a little box in the corner.
Right.
And it is spreading all over the place. Like Baskin-Robbins just created two new vegan flavors. And many restaurants have vegan options that didn't used to.
Exactly.
Well, you know, one of the things that you also talked about in your talk was about how we sort of have this, it's called psychic numbing. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's just a part of human nature that we protectively distance ourselves from loss of life that happens on a massive scale. Say you have thousands and thousands killed in an earthquake, a tsunami, some kind of natural disaster. We're somehow hardwired not to experience the suffering on a massive scale, but we do tend to identify with an individual's suffering. So that's part of the issue, that there's such a large amount of animal lives being lost, whether it's through species and habitat loss or the animal agriculture industry. But we tend to be removed from it. I mean, look at how, as a society, we're removed. We don't know where the slaughterhouses are. We're hearing marketing messages and advertisements all day.
Right.
And so we're, as a human race, we just tend to be very distanced from what is happening, even though society as a whole is very complicit in what's happening to these animals. It's much easier to comfortably say, I don't want to think about it. And mm-hmm. I'm sure you've all had that experience where you've talked to a friend or a family member and said, you know, there's all these awful things that happen to the animals, and they'll say, I don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
By remaining distant from what's happening in a way that enables them to keep on doing what they're doing.
Right.
And I believe that people feel comfortable, right, doing the things, the habits they had growing up. And I point out that that's the case with me. I grew up in Southern California in a family that ate animals, and I just never, ever thought about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's what it wasn't our fault. We were born into the cultural system, so to speak. And it wasn't until I was a graduate student in college that I realized and educated myself. And it was all because of this book that my husband brought home one day. It's called Animal Factories.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
Peter Singer.
Yeah, Peter Singer and Jim Mason.
Yeah.
Amazing. It was this thin volume with black and white pictures on the inside, and it told about what happens to animals in factory farms.
Mm-hmm.
And we were reading the book and realized, you know, we just never thought about this. So, of course, after we read the book from cover to cover, we decided that, you know, the very next day we were never going to eat animals again. So I think that points out the power of education, you know, that people need to look at their own power, that you can make decisions yourself. You can find the information, especially in this day and age,
yeah,
and make really powerful life decisions.
Yeah.
We're old school. We all went from books.
That's right.
Yeah, but it's kind of interesting to think about what made your husband pick up that particular book,
yeah,
too. So he must have been,
yeah,
thinking along those lines. Or
yeah, perhaps.
So I remember eating liver and onions that my mother served, and I pretended that it was tree bark.
Yeah.
Oh! Yeah. Probably
not sure that's any better. But,
I know.
Yeah.
I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, and I think that going back to your point of sort of this psychic numbing, you know, people also just stick their hands up because they feel like they can't make a difference.
Yeah.
But this is one of the few things in the world that you can actually take immediate,
right,
action on, and you have a direct impact on animals immediately once,
exactly,
you start, and the environment,
exactly,
and your health. So it's a great thing once people realize how powerful their choices are.
That's why I think one of the best forms of advocacy is to tell people and show people how to eat vegan, because a lot of people just don't have any idea.
Right.
Or don't. Right. They have this idea that, oh, I have to buy this fancy cooking equipment or it's going to be more expensive. And
yeah.
I always tell them, I say, eat beans and rice and throw a green salad together with kale and broccoli. And,
oh, my God, that's what I had last night.
Oh, you did. And I also point out to people that you're already mostly eating vegan,
yeah,
even,
right,
if you still consume animals.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
But that's not a good reason not to get rid of the animal products,
right,
of your,
right,
diet. Yeah, and...
Yeah.
Everybody has their own path, that's for sure, but anything,
exactly,
we can do to help them move along the path is very beneficial.
Right.
We're coming to the end of the show. Joanne, can you tell our listeners a website they can go to learn more about your work?
Yes, my website is vegansmakeadifference.com, And a really what I think is the best part of the website is under the stories section, I collect essays and photos from people who are vegan, and they reflect and write about their unique path. And every story is different. And I think for readers to read those stories really sends a very strong message that, as one of my fellow advocates always says, veganism is not a destination, it's a journey. And mm-hmm. it's one of the most powerful ways that we can bring positive change to the world.
We've been talking with Dr. Joanne Kong, who's a critically acclaimed concert pianist that we didn't get to talk about, and author of the book, If You've Ever Loved an Animal, Go Vegan. Thanks so much for your time today, Joanne.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Joanne.